We have four argued cases this morning. The first is number 21-2309, Dobbins v. United States. Mr. Reed.
May it please the Court, James Reed for Plaintiff Appellant J. Anthony Dobbins. Good morning. I'd like to focus on the trial court's orders and its interpretation of the Equal Access to Justice Act, which are reviewed de novo, and because there were no decisions made on the merits to each application, we would submit that it may be viewed as a summary proceeding and reviewed de novo as well. I believe the most helpful thing I can do for the Court this morning is to provide a brief chronology of the events that we believe told the filing deadline for the plaintiff's Equal Access to Justice application for fees. On May 1st, 2019, the trial court issued an order at Appendix 240 for the parties to provide a status report by May 17th, 2019 as to any unfinished court business. On May 15th, 2019, the parties filed a joint status report at Appendix 435. Plaintiff stated that he was filing a petition for certiorari, after which he would file an EJIA application for attorney's fees or, at minimum, defeating the government's counterclaims. Later that same day, May 15, 2019, the trial court issued an order found at Appendix 241 for the parties to file a joint status report within 60 days of the final resolution of the plaintiff's request for relief from the Supreme Court, indicating their proposed schedules for further proceedings in this matter. On February 4, 2020, the Supreme Court denied the petition for certiorari, and 25 days later, on March 20, 2020, the Supreme Court's denial and the Federal Circuit's reversal of plaintiff's trial victory became final. On April 20, 2020, counsel for plaintiff and the government exchanged emails in which the Justice Department agreed that an amended judgment needed to be issued. The Justice Department said, quote, "We don't need to ask the trial court to issue a new judgment. It will do that as a matter of course." And that's found in Appendix 74. On April 24, 2020, the parties filed a joint status report found in Appendix 440. Plaintiff described again his intent to file an EJIA application. On May 4th, 2020, the trial court issued an order stating that no amended judgment would be issued, and that's Appendix 242. The court noted that plaintiff intended to file an application for attorney's fees under the Equal Access to Justice Act. The court ordered the parties to file by May 18th, 2020, quote, a joint status report proposing a schedule, including specific calendar dates, to govern further proceedings in this case, end quote. On May 18, 2020, at Appendix 450, the parties filed a joint status report. The parties proposed August 17, 2020 as a date for plaintiff to file his previously described request for attorney's fees, along with any other motions. 2 days later, on May 20th, 2020, at Appendix 244, the trial court issued an order adopting the party's proposed schedule, setting August 17th, 2020 as plaintiff's deadline to file post-appeal motions, and commended the parties for working together to create this schedule. On August 14th, 2020, at Appendix 246, the court extended plaintiff's filing deadline to October 16th, 2020 for good cause shown with consent by the government.
Okay, I think we know what happened. But before getting into the merits of the equitable tolling...
Very good, so I'll move there right now. May I, Your Honor, I'll move there right now.
Well, I had a predicate question.
Yes, sir.
You seem to be claiming attorney's fees both with respect to the counterclaim, as to which I guess you were the prevailing party, but also on the merits of your own claim. And I'm not quite understanding how you were a prevailing party since you lost on your claim.
Your Honor, the standard, and those are in the cases cited by appellant's brief, the standard is to change the legal standing of the plaintiff as a result of prevailing. Now, Judge Allegra issued a number of findings of fact against the ATF. Those included that ATF intentionally exposed the plaintiff to danger by removing his COVID identifications, obstructing the investigation of the arson of his home, and then wrongfully pursuing him as a sole suspect.
That says that there's no case that I'm aware of that suggests that that makes you a prevailing party.
Your Honor, the cases that we cited indicated that an outcome which changed the legal relationship between the plaintiff and his employer is sufficient to obtain attorney's fees under EJIA. Now, granted that we did not win under the covenant of good faith and fair dealing, Your Honor, as you well know, as one of the authors of that opinion. However, after those findings of fact were issued, Agent Dobbins was no longer a suspect in this case. He was exonerated in a 55-page trial court opinion as an arson suspect, and he was no longer pursued. He was also characterized as a whistleblower. All of these things are vital alterations to his relationship with ATF.
Okay, and Robert, but I understand your point. Why don't you go on to the equitable tolling issue?
I'm sorry. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Now, the trial court's orders dated May 15, 2019, May 4, 2020, and May 20, 2020 all caused plaintiff to reasonably believe the court had suspended and then extended plaintiff's time to file his EJIA application as foremost among the further proceedings for which the court requested and then adopted a stipulated schedule of proceedings. Nowhere did the trial court try to exclude from plaintiff's EJIA filing from the court's multiple references to, quote, further proceedings in its request for scheduling order. The court did not do so until
Listen a little bit better. Can I ask you this? Why would anything said by the trial court about scheduling that was actually said after March 20th, 2020 matter?
Your Honor, this order is May 15th, 2019.
I know one of them, but you group all these things together, and it feels important for, I think, a pretty obvious reason to separate those statements, orders by the district court that came after the deadline passed from those that which came before. Now, presumably, statements afterwards, if they were clear enough, might indicate that there was, in fact, a new deadline. But these don't quite do that. So which are the ones that preceded the running of the deadline, which I think you said was March 20th, 2019, and why do those create a basis for equitable tolling?
Your Honor, if I may, the judgment became non-appealable and final after the Supreme Court, after the petition for rehearing time expired before the Supreme Court on March 20th. The 30-day period then, under the trial court's perspective, was April 19th, not May. So it's a belt and suspenders argument, Your Honor. There's two different reasons. Apart from the May 15th, 2019 scheduling order, the agreement by the government in writing in our brief that an amended judgment would issue would start the EJIA filing period at the date of issuance of the amended judgment.
And right, so my recollection from reading these papers is that that passage in that email is far and away the most significant thing to think about. And I think what the claims court said about that was there was no kind of agreement in the sense of a contract between the parties, although it's unclear what the status of that would have been had it existed. It was rather one lawyer predicting something and another lawyer saying, okay, and the claims court said you weren't entitled to rely on that prediction.
And as we specifically stated in the briefs, Your Honor, we did not claim that there was a binding oral agreement with the Department of Justice, nor did we claim that the Department of Justice was empowered to do that. What we claimed was that the Department of Justice had waived its right to object to the filing period for EJIA opening prior to the date that they revealed that they were going to recant that position on April 24th, 2020. Now, it does matter, and our decisions that we cite indicate that the government can waive those deadlines and waive its objection to object to those deadlines. The point being, then, if under Your Honor's perspective of this, and I respectfully disagree that the court's order governing further proceedings did not include EJIA, but if we go with Your Honor's perspective of this, that what matters is the predictions and the perspective of the Department of Justice, then April 24, 2020 was the date that the EJIA 30-day filing window opened. Now, just 10 days later, the trial court issued its order on May 4th, specifically referring to plaintiff's intent to file an EJIA application. That May 4th order renewed the court's May 15th, 2019 request for the parties to stipulate to a schedule for post-appeal motions, including the EJIA application. That order also indicated for the first time that no new judgment would issue. So up until that point, there was a common assumption between the two parties that an amended judgment would issue and that the EJIA filing window had not opened. Even if the trial court's May 4th order were found to start the EJIA filing period by announcing for the first time that no amended judgment would issue, the court then adopted the party's filing schedule just 16 days later on May 20th, 2020. And under the multiple decisions that are cited by plaintiff in the opening reply briefs, the government waived any timeliness objections when it attempted to recant its agreement that a new judgment would issue through to April 24th, 2020. Again, just 10 days later, the court directed the parties to stipulate to a briefing schedule, and 16 days later, the court adopted it. Now, the decisions citing that waiver and tolling perspective include North Carolina Alliance, the Northern District of Ohio decision of Vasquez versus Barnett, and the District of Kansas decision in Owen House versus Commodity Credit Card. Now, the trial court in its May 15th, 2019 order and in its May 2020 order consistently used the term further proceedings to include plaintiff's EJIA application. And by those orders and by the trial court's subsequent orders granting plaintiff's consent motion to plaintiff's filing deadline as August 17, 2020, which the court specifically did, the trial court suspended and extended the EJIA filing date. And at minimum, it should be found to have told it under equitable grounds. If somehow the trial court did not understand that it was doing so, or that it was reasonable for the plaintiff to believe it was doing so, that is not the fault of the plaintiff, nor should it be to the prejudice of the plaintiff. And specifically, Your Honor, as we cite in our opening brief at page 37, the Middle District of North Carolina in the North Carolina Alliance for Transportation Reform versus Department of Transportation decision, in reviewing each of section 2412D1B motion for fees, wrote, "The Supreme Court has recognized that a court may equitably toll a deadline where the court leaves the plaintiff to believe that he has done everything required of him." We could not have been more clear that we were filing EJIA application. We made it clear in our May 15, 2019 status report, and the court referred to all further proceedings as being subject to the court's, to the party's stipulated scheduling order. And, Your Honor, as I was going to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay, well,
I will just say that as for the 2412, now we've been talking about 2412D, as for 2412B, which is governed by Claims Court Rule 54, even the rule itself states this 30-day deadline can be modified by court order. And the U.S. Supreme Court decision in Scarborough versus Principi in 2004 made clear that 2412D1B's 30-day deadline is subject to equitable tolling because the 30 days is not prejudicial. Finally, Your Honor, I did put in the briefs that the extraordinary interruptions due to COVID after March 20, 2020, made the production of the EJIA application impossible, either by April 19, 2020, or by May 4 or May 20, 2020. The time entries for the 6 years were housed at two prior law firms, which had closed and were inaccessible during COVID. Each of these factors is an independent and sufficient reason to find plaintiff's EJIA filing deadline tolled. And coupled with the absence of prejudice from plaintiff being heard on the merits of his EJIA application, this, we believe, should guide the court to reverse the trial court's July 1, 2021 order denying attorney's fees and costs. And I'll reserve the last minute and a half for rebuttal.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Reed.
Thank you.
Mr. Grimaldi.
May it please the Court, Your Honor, I've gotten so used to Room 201, there's a longer walk here. I have to bring everything up with me. Can't just turn around and grab them from the table. Apologize for that.
So does the government agree that equitable tolling would be available both for the statutory deadline and the deadline in the rule?
Well, Scarborough does seem to say that because it's a statutory deadline and not a jurisdictional deadline, that there is equitable tolling is available. The Townsend case that's referenced in our briefing from the Sixth Circuit has found that equitable tolling is available. It ultimately denied it in the subsequent decision. But it does seem like that's where the jurisdictions are going, Your Honor, yes.
Okay, so I'm a little puzzled as to the government's position as to why equitable tolling is not available here. I mean, the quintessential Supreme Court case on equitable tolling is Irwin. And Irwin gives us an example of a situation where someone's misled by an adversary, a case called Glaus, which is not cited by either party. It's 359 U.S. 231. And in Glaus, the Supreme Court held that where somebody had represented to the other party that the statute of limitations was 7 years when it was a shorter period, that was sufficient to create equitable tolling. And I guess I'm looking at the facts of this case, and they seem to me to be somewhat similar to Glaus. So why, I mean, assuming my description of Glaus is accurate, and equitable tolling existed where one party told the other that the statute of limitations was longer than it in fact was, why isn't that like this here?
Well, if Your Honor, before I answer that question, which I 100% will, Your Honor, I do want to point this to the standard of review here for equitable tolling, which would be abuse of discretion.
Now, there's some let's answer the question first.
Yeah, so we're looking into whether the trial court made an irrational judgment when it disagreed with that.
What the trial court said was the parties can't extend the time by agreement. That's not a viable theory.
I disagree with that, Your Honor. That's not what the trial court
Answer my question, okay?
Yeah, I am, right now. Your Honor, that's not what the trial court said.
Not that question. The question about Glaus.
Yeah.
Why isn't this like Glaus?
Well, the trial court found that Mr. Dobbins identified that there was an extension of time based on a trial court's filings, right? The trial court's orders. The ones predating and postdating, as Your Honor points out, as well as the statement from the DOJ counsel. So what the trial court found was the reason for the delay when looking at that part of the excusable neglect test was a misreading of those orders, as well as Mr. Dobbins should have done the research himself.
So well, you could say that about Glaus, too. I mean, here's one party saying to the other, the statute of limitations is 7 years. The other party doesn't bother to look it up, and yet the Supreme Court says there's equitable tolling. Same thing here. You told him that there was no need to ask for an order, that the trial court would automatically issue a new judgment, which would start the period for the attorney's fees motion.
Well, I think the government counsel in this case agreed with Mr. Dobbins about the amendment job. When you look at the statement of what it was said, Your Honor, I think, and I don't want to just say it off the top of my head because I don't want to misrepresent it, so I'm going to jump back into the court decision here, Your Honor, and get it exactly.
Well, it said, I don't think we need ask the trial court to issue a new judgment. It will do that as a matter of course.
Right. So what Mr. Dobbins, how he describes the situation, is a mutual mistake of fact, not a relying on.
He makes multiple arguments, one of which is that he was misled by his adversary, that is you, the Justice Department. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And you told him that there would, not you personally, but that there would be a new judgment which would start the time. That was wrong.
Well,
why isn't that sufficient for equitable tolling?
Well, the question was whether there would be a new judgment. I'm a little nuanced on what's going to say that, but I'm going to skip that, Your Honor, and focus on this. What the trial court found was that, especially after it was like 10 years of hard fighting against the government. It was unreasonable for Mr. Dobbins to rely on a statement from government counsel in that case. So it was...
This was an exceedingly friendly, cooperative email.
Correct.
This was not... I will say absolutely nothing that creates the slightest risk of helping your case.
Mm-hmm. Well, Your Honor, and just to, you know, for my own sake, I've enjoyed working with Mr. Reed and there's been no issues. But at that time, the other motions that are mentioned in the trial court decision, the orders that are going to be filed, are attempts to seek criminal sanctions against government employees, civil sanctions against them. There is still a tension between these parties at this time. It wasn't all copacetic, even though the tone of the government's email there was very... polite, let's say.
But the email misled him, didn't it?
Well, I think the email didn't correct his misunderstanding. Because the email that was sent suggested...
Well, he said that the trial court will enter a new judgment. We don't need to do anything.
Correct, because the premise of the mutual misunderstanding is that an amended judgment would be coming, right, Your Honor? That there would be an amended judgment. There was a need for one. Mr. Dobbins' counsel suggested that, and government counsel did not correct him, because the government counsel...
No, it's more than that. He actually told him that there would be no need for a new judgment because the trial court would enter one as a matter of course.
I don't think we're disagreeing, Your Honor.
So why isn't that sufficient to misleading behavior to qualify for equitable tolling?
Well, Your Honor, as we said in our briefs, as the trial court said, which again this court is reviewing for an irrational judgment, that it was Mr. Dobbins' responsibility to do his own research on this and not just trust a statement from government counsel on it. And I'm aware of a case that...
The way I think that... Judge Dyke framed the point before is that what appears to have been the case is that the claims court relied on an incorrect legal proposition that an adversary's representation cannot be the basis for equitable tolling. That wouldn't be so much irrational as one ground for abuse of discretion, which is reliance on an incorrect legal view.
Right. I don't think the trial court goes that far, Your Honor, to say that this, and I wasn't going to come up here and tell you today that nothing the government can say could ever cause equitable tolling. That's not our position. But we didn't see this statement in particular as being problematic. As the court had pointed out, that there was a history between the parties, a contentious history. And also the statement itself, as I've discussed, Your Honor, I don't think there's a lot of difference between what we're saying, Your Honor, but the spin that we see on this is that the statement is not purposely pushing Mr. Dobbins in a direction he wasn't already going, but just failed to correct his mistake.
Well, it did more than that. It said explicitly, we don't need to ask for a new judgment because the court will automatically enter one. Yeah. And if he trusted that...
But he didn't, Your Honor. The record shows that. No.
How does the record show
that? Well, the record shows that on April 22nd...
After the deadline.
Correct, after the deadline. That is, but it's referring back to an order from a year ago. Okay, Your Honor? So, yes, that is pointed out in reply to you that this is 3 days too late, my thought process here. But it's relying on an order from May 1st, 2019, Your Honor, where it shows the trial court isn't going to do anything but terminate the case. So that order has been sitting out for a while now. And that was, if I'm remembering correctly, appendix page 926.
Is this the same as 240?
No, I was talking about the email itself, but 240, I think that's correct. If you want to go to the order, Your Honor, yes.
Right, but that doesn't... That doesn't say, does it, that once the clock runs on the Supreme Court process, there will be no need for any further action?
That's the problem in this entire case. Nothing is explicit. Everything that we're going through here, Your Honor, there's been no explicit, this is your deadline for your EJIP application, and that's why we're here today, right? Because the parties are interpreting these differently. But what the email from April 22nd, 2020 shows is that Mr. Dobbins interpreted this order as not doing anything, as saying that there wouldn't be amended judgment, that the case would just be terminated.
How about the schedule orders that the court adopted that mentioned the EJIA case, the EJIA application?
Well, as the trial court said, there was nothing stopping from parties from filing motions within their actual deadlines. That 60-day deadline for the JSR was to deal with numerous things that were going to be filed, like the criminal motions that I mentioned and the sanction motions. So the trial court found that basically a party should be doing the research, figuring out what the deadlines are, and filing appropriate motions when they're due, and not just waiting for the JSR.
If Your Honor, on that theory, Glaus was decided incorrectly.
Your Honor, you're right that the parties didn't address Glaus, so I am not familiar with its facts. I apologize for that.
Well, I gave you the facts. They told him there was 7 years. And you could just as easily say, well, you should have done your own research to figure out it wasn't 7 years.
Yes. I don't know what to say, Your Honor, because, as I said, I'm not familiar with, let's say, all the facts of that case. But the facts here show that from this order in 2019, there was doubt that their case would have an amendment judgment, that there would just be a termination, and that carried out in April 22nd, 2020, which Your Honor points out 3 days after the deadline, that Mr. Dobbins was interpreting that order from the year before as the case would just be terminated, no amended judgment.
And am I remembering correctly or incorrectly that the first assertion by the department that a fees application would be untimely came after the deadline ran?
To the court, yes. I wasn't involved in the case at that time. I'm not sure what happened between April 8th and April 19th.
There's
and
nothing
19th.
On the record to suggest that you raise the timeliness issue.
Well, it's not to the court, Your Honor, but it does seem that the parties discussed it.
Right? Sorry? Not to your adversary either.
I don't know, Your Honor.
Shows that you did.
Correct. That's what I was trying to say, Your Honor, that there's nothing to show that in between those two time periods what happened. But there was some discussion, because by the time the JSR came out, if you read the position of the plaintiff, appellant in that JSR, they are aware of the government's timeliness argument. So there was some discussion at some point. I just don't know the date, Your Honor. It's not in the record. Your Honor, my time is low here. I would want to just address your preliminary question that you mentioned about the change in legal relationship and can there be EJIA and a prevailing party. And this is, of course, Your Honor's know, this is not something that was briefed because the trial court didn't reach this. But our review of the case law is that there needs to be a change in the legal relationship that directly benefits the party.
And it was on the counterclaim, right?
There wasn't a counterclaim, but we also haven't found a case where a party lost on its claim, won on a counterclaim, and got each of these either. So the case that cited United Construction as being able to get each of these on a counterclaim, they were the prevailing party on their own claim as well. Here, Mr. Dobbins sought ultimately $17.2 million on his affirmative claim after some amendments, and after this court's decision got $0. So he's going to run into a prevailing party issue. He's also going to run into a substantially justified issue. Because the Commissioner INS v. Gene case says that you need to look at holistically an entire case to determine whether or not the government is substantially justified. This is a contract case where Mr. Dobbins sought $17.2 million, and he got zero, and yes, he defeated the counterclaim.
How much was the government seeking in the counterclaim?
I'm not remembering at this time. I apologize, Your Honor. But if looking at the totality, holistically, not substantially justified. There's nothing the government could have done. There's no wiggle room between the zero and $17.2 million.
What? I don't understand what you're saying. Well, yeah. Not be entitled to $17 million, but maybe they spent $100,000 in defending against the counterclaim or something like that. That wouldn't.
Well, I was talking about the for the main issue, Your Honor, $17.2 million is on the main issue, the affirmative case for Mr. Dobbins.
How much do you seek on the counterclaim?
Your Honor just asked. I can't remember how much.
I thought they settled for a certain amount.
There's no settlement in this.
There's no settlement?
That's correct. The United States lost the counterclaim, and Mr. Dobbins lost his affirmative claim. It's been 2 months this year.
Okay, but to be clear, I was asking a different question than Judge Romano was asking. I thought he was asking what the amount of the counterclaim ad damnum was. I'm asking how much attorney's fees did they spend in defending against the counterclaim?
So this was briefed below, and I think that Mr. Dobbins' counsel did an admirable job of trying to parse through and figure out what his attorney's fees were for the counterclaim, but the United States did point out that it's speculation, in our opinion, that it's too hard to tell what attorney's fees were spent on what.
Well, what did he say were the attorney's fees attributable to the counterclaim?
Well, if I'm remembering correctly, Your Honor, the application is actually in the record here.
Oh, that's all right.
I just found the page if you want, Your Honor, wants me to look at it. So it looks like it's 512. And then towards the end of it is where he discusses quantum. And there were some numbers going back and forth, but the fees incurred to date were something like $731,000. And it says $146,399 related to the government's counterclaim and Dobbins' defenses there, too. So I would say about $147,000, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Reed.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Reed.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'll clean up some issues that the court asked about. First of all, in terms of whether or not there is a case awarding a counterclaim success attorney's fees under EJA, that's cited at page 49 of our opening brief. That's United Construction Company versus United States, where the federal courts have found several positions to entitle a prevailing defendant to a pro rata award of attorney's fees under EJA for defeating a counterclaim. With respect to how much the government sought under its counterclaim, it sought a regurgitation of the movie contract and the book royalties totaling approximately $500,000. With respect to whether or not the government can be stopped or found to have waived an objection to the timeliness of a EJA application, that is the Olin House decision, which we cite at page 19 of our reply brief, and it is the North Carolina Alliance decision that we cite at page 37 of our opening brief. Now, with respect to the April 22 email, the court asked whether there was anything in the record that the government changed their position prior to April 24. Not only is there nothing in the record, and as the trial attorney, I can vouch for that, but the timeliness issue was not raised until April 24th, and the April 22 email confirms that was still the understanding of the parties. Now, this is not an issue of research. It is a matter of when each window would open, and that would be at the earliest May 4th, 2020, when the trial court stated that no amended judgment would issue. And our position is that the court then adopted the schedule of the parties in less than 30 days after that.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Reed. Thank you, counsel. The case is submitted.